Hello, this is Perry, and you're listening to the Chemist Corner podcast for Friday, April 9th, 2010. Welcome to Chemist Corner. I'm your host, Perry Romanowski. Chemist's Corner is a podcast about cosmetic science and is broadcast to help educate, entertain, and inspire current and future cosmetic scientists. The information and opinions discussed on Chemist's Corner are those of the hosts and the guest alone. They do not necessarily reflect those of any past, present, or future employers. My co-host, Kelly Dobos, couldn't join us today, so I'll be doing most of the show solo. We did manage to record one segment together, so she will make an appearance later on. On today's show, we're going to cover some cosmetic science news, review of the top cosmetic science topics not covered in college, and we'll have an interview with cosmetic science consultant Kevin Young. In the interview, we talk about what it's like to be a consultant, how the industry has changed over the years, and the benefits of joining the Society of Cosmetic Chemists, or the SCC. First up, the news. I've got one news story I'd like to talk about today. I was perusing Happy, I believe, and they reported on a study published by Consumer Reports. The May issue of Consumer Reports looked at anti-wrinkle serums. Their conclusion was that consumers are better off spending money on sunscreen or moisturizer than anti-wrinkle facial serums. The magazine tested 9 face serums and found only minor and inconsistent improvements among test subjects. The effectiveness of even the best-performing product was limited, varying from test subject to test subjects. The products that they tested ranged in price from $20 to $65, and they were all available in either drugstores, department stores, and specialty beauty shops. Now, according to the Consumer Reports article, there were 2 serums that rated slightly better, but the differences were so slight, I'm not even going to mention the brand names. Now, while the story is interesting for anyone who follows beauty products, it's not going to come as a surprise to most cosmetic chemists. There is so much more hype in anti-aging products than actual functionality, it really is no surprise, at least to me. But the reason I really wanted to talk about this story was because it comes from Consumer Reports. Now, Consumer Reports, if you don't know, it's a great magazine that proposes to test products and give an unbiased judgment about whether they are worth the money or not. They started out in reviewing cars, and then they went to appliances, and now they go to pretty much any consumer products, and beauty products fall in there. It's a laudable goal. However, I had an experience early on in my cosmetic science career that made me a bit skeptical of some of their conclusions, or at least of their testing. So some time ago, probably in the early 1990s, they did a review of shampoos. And so they went and tested, you know, all the shampoos on the market at the time. And they just happened to test 2 shampoos that I personally worked with. So I knew the formulas, and I also knew that the formulas differed very little. In fact, the only difference was in the fragrance and some of the feature ingredients. And the color, of course, and the product names. But from a formula standpoint, it would be appear if you tested these products in the lab, there really shouldn't be a difference. But in the Consumer Reports study, there was a difference between the 2 formulas, so one scored significantly higher than the other one. And so from then on, I've always been a bit skeptical about the results that I see published in Consumer Reports, especially for cosmetic products. Now in this study, the wrinkle study, they looked at 9 serums, and they tested it on 79 participants. So since this is a half-face study, which means they treated one side of the face with one product and another side of the face with another product, this gave them about 158 sites to work with. So each product could be tested a maximum of about 17 people or 17 data points. And really, this just isn't enough data points in skin testing to draw any significant conclusions. The other problem with this study is that there were no positive and negative controls, which makes it even less valuable. A positive control would have been something like Retin A, which is a prescription product that actually has been shown scientifically to improve fine lines and wrinkles. And then a negative control would just be any old skin lotion that's not expected to have any effect on wrinkling. But they didn't include these, or at least not that I could tell from the story. So, all this said, I probably agree with their conclusion. There probably isn't enough data suggesting that wrinkle serums are worth spending any money on. But while I agree with the conclusion, I don't think that the study they did is adequate to support their conclusions. I mean, kudos to Consumer Reports for evaluating these products, but I really wish they would do a little better science. Okay, our next topic is cosmetic science. So these are topics for cosmetic chemists that were barely covered in college. You know, you're in college, and as we mentioned last time, that the word surfactant wasn't really even memorably mentioned during your college career. But there's a lot of other things that you're going to have to deal with as a cosmetic scientist that also weren't mentioned in college. So we're going to go through our list of 10 that you should know about that you probably didn't learn about in college. So first up is surfactants. And surfactants are just, it's a shorter way to say surface active agent, but essentially these molecules have the property, they reduce surface tension and they thereby allow oil and water to form these stable and temporary mixtures. But essentially surfactants in cosmetic formulas are used for lots of stuff. Detergents, wetting agents, foaming agents, they're emulsifiers, they're solubilizers, preservatives, lots of special effects. And they're things like sodium lauryl sulfate, cocamidyl propyl betaine. Really, surfactants make up a huge part of any cosmetic formula.
Number two is emulsions. And emulsions are dispersions of one phase in another. And your emulsions can be oil and water, water and oil, and then you can get some fancy multiple emulsions. But foam is also an emulsion. It's an emulsion of air in a liquid. And those are important in hair care, and regular emulsions are important in skin care and hair care as well.
The next topic is fatty acids. While some college time was devoted to learning about acid-base reactions, we didn't spend a lot of time talking about the properties and the chain length distributions of any of these specific fatty acids. But when you talk about cosmetic raw materials, you know, most of them are based on fatty acid chemistry. And specifically, the industry uses a lot of fatty acids, those that have carbon chain lengths between 8 and 22 carbons. They're used mainly as the basis for surfactants, and they come from stuff like coconut and palm kernel and sunflower oils. And you'll find them in lots of formulas as used as conditioning agents, thickening agents, secondary emulsifiers, and opacifying agents.
And then before we got silicone, silicones in the cosmetic industry are relatively, kind of newcomers to the game. They were first developed for use in the aerospace industry and then found their way into cosmetics as ancillary usages. But silicones have very unique properties, allowing them to give great skin feel in lotions and creams. And then they also act to smooth the cuticle in hair conditioning products.
Love silicones. All right, then there's polymers, and you might have taken a class in polymer chemistry, but really the focus was like on the molecular structure and maybe how to synthesize them, and not really so much on what you do with a polymer. But in the cosmetic industry, of course, it's all about what you do with polymers. Specifically, you'll see ingredients like polyquaternium 7 or polyquaternium 10, or my personal favorite molecule, PVP. Do you know PVP is the little thing that is used to stick the M on M&Ms? Yeah.
Interesting.
Polymers are used as thickeners. They're used as foam stabilizers, conditioning agents, opacifying agents. You can even use them as preservatives. And really, the whole basis for styling products to hold hair in place is mostly based on polymers.
Skin biology is also something that we don't learn much about in our undergraduate courses. And that's kind of odd considering our skin is the largest organ on our body. By understanding skin biology and skin physiology further, we're able to develop more effective products, help treat skin diseases like psoriasis, and also understand skin irritation and sensitization in developing our products. It's very important.
Hair biology. You know, while you might have picked up a few facts about human skin, you probably learned even less about human hair in your biology courses. I know I did, and I was a bio major for my first 4 years in college. I took an extra year just because it was fun. Yet, you know, one-third of all the products launched in the cosmetic industry are formulated for hair. So some basic things you should know about hair is that it's made of keratin protein. It has a couple of layers, the cortex and the cuticle. The cuticle is responsible for the appearance and the feel of hair, and the cortex is responsible for the hair's strength and flexibility. But the overall thing that you should know about hair is that hair is dead tissue. So this notion of healthy hair is always a bit of a marketing misnomer, because dead things can't really be healthy, or at least your hair can't be any more healthy than, say, a shoelace.
All right. Speaking of keeping things healthy, product preservation, and it's a complex mix of biology and chemistry. We as cosmetic chemists need to preserve our products so that we keep consumers safe. We don't want bacteria, yeast, or molds growing in our product that can cause potential problems for the end consumer, especially when we store our cosmetic products most frequently in the bathroom, which is a nice, warm, moist environment that is a happy home for microbial growth.
And a happy home for lizards in some people's houses. The next topic that you won't have learned much about in college is chemical nomenclature. I remember looking at shampoo bottles when I was in college and looking at the ingredients and thinking that I might recognize something. And the only thing I ever recognized was water and sodium chloride, because those are the only names that made sense. But the chemicals in the cosmetic industry are all based on the INCI system, not on the IUPAC system that you might have learned in college. The INCI is the International Nomenclature of Cosmetic Ingredients, and when you get into the industry, you'll learn just the different names for chemicals.
And lastly on our list of 10 things in cosmetic science that you may have not learned in school, is stability testing. When we develop a product, we need to ensure that that product's performance doesn't change over the lifetime of that product. And a cosmetic product usually needs to be stable for about 2 or 3 years on the shelf and in the consumer's home. So we do accelerated stability testing at higher temperatures, which pushes the boundaries on chemical instabilities, as well as freeze-thaw testing for situations the product might experience in transit to its location, and room temperature stability, which we're also looking for our physical instabilities. And when it comes to OTC drug products, we have to test the stability of those active ingredients within that product to ensure that if the consumer doesn't get to use that product until maybe a year down the road, that product still meets the efficacy requirements that it needs to.
Absolutely. All right, there you have it, the 10 things that you didn't learn in college that are very important for you to know when you're starting in the cosmetic industry. Kevin Young has been a cosmetic chemist for 35 years. He has formulated cosmetic products for several major cosmetic companies, including Maybelline and Almay. He now owns his own independent laboratory and consulting service, KY Labs. Welcome to the program, Kevin Young.
Thank you very much, Perry.
So how are you today, Kevin?
I'm well, thank you. Nice and sunny out today.
It's a little gloomy and cloudy here in Chicago. We've had you on the program here today because I've enjoyed following your discussions that we've had on the Yahoo Cosmetic Science group, and I was interested to learn that you were involved in starting up the SEC chapter in the Carolinas. First, I want to talk to you about how you got involved in cosmetic chemistry. So how did you get started as a cosmetic chemist?
Well, Perry, as you probably know, in colleges today, there are several colleges that do offer some programs in cosmetic science, most notably master's programs. But back in my days in college, no such thing existed. In fact, I actually started off in college looking at engineering as a career path. And at that time, I was working as a land surveyor in civil engineering type projects back in the early to mid 70s. At a time when the building economy in this country was not doing very well. Some of us who are old enough will remember those days. In fact, that was a recessionary time back then. And having struggled jumping from one engineering firm to another, because as they would gain or lose contracts, they would hire or let go of their staff, I finally got fed up with it and went to the Tennessee Department of Employment Security, said I need a job. They said, well, there's a company that's looking for a laboratory technician. I said, well, I've got college chemistry. Let's give it a shot. And that shop turned out to be Maybelline Cosmetics in Memphis. And after working there for about 6 months, I said, you know, this is fun. It's the only job I know where I can come home with lipstick on my collar, perfume on my sleeve. My wife doesn't ask why. And it's been fun ever since.
And so Maybelline was your first company. And what types of things did you work on?
Well, Maybelline segmented their R&D laboratories into specific product categories. I was in the eye area product group, and specifically I was working on mascara products. Mascaras were a product that most of the chemists there absolutely hated to work on because of the fact that they were dirty and not particularly pleasant to work with, very messy working with black all day long. But I found it to be a rather interesting challenge because consumers who use the mascaras know that you're looking to apply a film to the eyelash, which is going to demonstrably build up the appearance of the lash, and yet be plastic enough not to flake off, and yet rigid enough not to smudge and smear. And so you've got this dichotomy of product attributes that you're trying to balance when developing the formulation. And it's the type of challenge which I have found that stimulates my creative juices within this industry.
Now, you talked about how mascara was. Is it still the same case with mascara these days?
Frankly, Perry, I haven't worked on mascaras in quite a number of years, although I occasionally take a look at ingredient listings and such. I still see the same complexities that are involved in mascaras. The different marketers are still trying to get a different hook. They put in other claims ingredients, but your basic foundation for a mascara is still to create a film which is plastic and yet smudge-proof.
So it's still probably a challenging formula to work on, huh?
It is.
Okay, after Maybelline, you spent some time at Almay, and what kind of things did you do over there?
Well, Almay Cosmetics was dedicated to developing hypoallergenic products. Hypoallergenic was a term that the FDA originally did not allow cosmetic companies to utilize. They said it was undefined. And Almay had actually litigated FDA and won because we had a 13-point definition of what contributed a product to being declared as hypoallergenic. And so the FDA said, okay, you can call your products hypoallergenic. After Almay won that litigation, many companies started calling their products hypoallergenic, but used their own definition for what they said was a hypoallergenic product. But at Almay, again, I was hired specifically to work on mascaras initially. Other products that I worked on were some nail care products, hair care products, because mascaras went on eyelashes, which were hair. It was decided that our staff, which at the time only consisted of 3 chemists and 5 technicians, should have me as their hair care chemist. And so I developed shampoos, conditioners, lip balms, and then again, because of our small staff, I was assigned OTC drugs, notably antiperspirants, sunscreens. That was about it. I also had the responsibility for our bar soaps that we had.
Mm-hmm.
Bar soaps were actually made by other contract manufacturers for us.
So you went from knowing how to formulate this one type of product to having to learn to formulate a whole bunch of products in a pretty short amount of time.
Exactly. And again, the foundation for all of this work really is a knowledge and understanding of emulsion chemistry. The majority of the mascaras were emulsions. Hair conditioners are another type of emulsion, whereas the mascaras were anionic soap-based emulsions on triphenolamine, stearic acid, or other alkanol, alkanolamines, and fatty acids. the hair conditioners were cationic-based emulsions. I created a rather novel cationic emulsion using an imidoamine and neutralizing it partially with two other organic acids, using citric acid and using lactic acid as the neutralizers for an imidoamine to make a rather novel hair conditioner.
Mm-hmm.
Unfortunately, this product never became commercial because during this period of time, Alme was purchased by International Playtex, which at the time was owned by Beatrice Foods. And for the next several years, we went through this process of who's going to own us. Beatrice also bought the company which owned Max Factor, which had a manufacturing facility 50 miles north of us, and a task force was set up to determine whether they could combine the manufacturing synergies of Max Factor and Alme and put them into a single location. That went on for over 5 years. And on top of everything else, Beatrice also owned Germac, and they were moving the Germac formulation work out of California and wanted to put that into the North Carolina facilities of Alme. So, again, these were some very interesting times within the industry. Ultimately, Alme was sold to Revlon, and at that time, Alme had 6 chemists in North Carolina, and Revlon had 135 in Edison. And I decided that my job security did not look very good and was recruited by another company.
Okay, and so you went to that next company, but at some point you ventured out and started your own company.
Well, that occurred in 1997. When I left Alme, that was in 1987, and I went to work for Colmar Laboratories in Port Jervis, New York, a contract manufacturer. And Colmar was my first exposure to working not for a finished goods manufacturer, but for a company that made products for lots of other companies. That was a very different experience from what I was used to. Colmar hired me specifically for my background in mascaras, but also they put me into their corporate R&D. They had 5 different R&D groups, and I was placed into corporate R&D, and specifically corporate R&D's charge was to develop products for their divisions. But because of my background in mascaras, I was also put in charge of developing specific mascaras for certain key customers, including Elizabeth Arden, where I developed their two-brush mascara. After a couple of years, Colmar had a bad year, and as I later found out, when times were good, Colmar would hire staff like crazy. When times started to fluctuate, they would let staff go. And so I was let go in 1989 and went to work for Dell Laboratories on Long Island. But Dell was in a location that I absolutely abhorred. And I took a job working then for a company best known for shoe polish named Kiwi Brands.
Mm-hmm.
And Kiwi Brands, a small division of Kiwi Brands, which actually came from Nicholas Laboratories, which was a global pharmaceutical manufacturer, they had ethnic skincare products under the trade name of AMBI, A-M-B-I.
Mm-hmm.
And these were OTC drugs. These were under the skin bleaching monograph of the OTC review based on hydroquinone. But Kiwi, as a shoe polish manufacturer, didn't market products the way that most cosmetic companies do. And while I was there for 5 years, and we developed and introduced more new products in my 5-year tenure than they had in the 10 years prior to my coming on board with Kiwi, it was a company that simply was not able to sustain its ability to make and sell cosmetics. And Kiwi, which was owned by Sara Lee Corporation, decided to centralize their R&D for personal care products out of The Hague, Netherlands, where they had a large staff for their European operations. So with that, Kiwi had some fundamental changes in management and staffing, and I took a position working for a contract manufacturer located close to my home here in Pennsylvania. And it was through this contract manufacturer that I ultimately met the individual who started me off in KY Labs back in 1997. I was technical director for Imperial Cosmetics, which the owner of the company, shortly after I joined the company, said, "I'm selling it to Colmar." And I said, "Well, I appreciate you telling me that you're selling it to Colmar. I've done that dance already, and I didn't want to do it again." And so I left to go to a drug company down in South Jersey, which got shut down by the USDA for poultry vaccine GMP violations. And at that point, a gentleman by the name of Donald Beldock, who was a friend of the owner of Imperial Cosmetics, heard that I was available, and he wanted to have a meeting with me. He had some ideas. He was wanting to market a product that was a insect repelling sunscreen. We were developing this product for Bath and Body Works, and he set me up in business. And that was in March of 1997 at KY Labs.
Wow. And how have you liked doing your own consulting?
It's the hardest job I've ever had.
Really?
Because I'm my own hardest boss. It was a job that I started working. I would get up in the morning, and after having breakfast, I'd be down in my laboratory at 7 o'clock in the morning. I would work until 7, 8 o'clock at night, stopping only for a half hour for lunch, another half an hour for dinner. Many times I would have meetings with my clients. Donald was residing at the Westchester Country Club in Rye, New York, and I can't tell you how many times I was in Rye, New York until 2 in the morning in a meeting to discuss product, to discuss marketing strategies, etc., only to go back to my house, which was a two-hour drive away, sleep for a couple of hours, get back up, and start again. But it was also the most satisfying job I've ever had. I mean, certainly it's the shortest commute I've ever had, going from my downstairs to my upstairs, or vice versa. But at the same time, people also said, well, you know, you're working from your house. I said, well, I used to say that I had my laboratory in my house, and then later I started saying that I started living in my laboratory, because as I continued to work and get busy, my laboratory setup took over more and more square footage in my house. Started off that I had an office and a lab in my basement of my house. I set up an area inside the basement for doing my incubators for stability testing. Set up an area to do filling of packages. Eventually, I had no more space in the basement to store the materials that I needed. I bought a trailer for a storage area, for a portable storage area, so I didn't have to worry about zoning regulations or anything of this nature, and use that as my warehouse to store chemicals and packaging. I had drums of chemicals underneath the deck in my backyard. As I say, my business overtook my house. My wife was not happy.
I don't imagine. So what advice would you have for a beginning cosmetic chemist?
Okay. Having recently been a hiring manager at a consulting firm, I would look for people who had the same type of drive that I had. And as I said to you before we started this discussion, Perry, there aren't any schools that really offer undergraduate degrees in cosmetic science. The only schools that offer any type of education in cosmetic science, generally speaking, you'll have a little bit of technology in pharmaceutical schools, or you can look at the master's programs that are available at Fairleigh Dickinson University or at the University of Ohio, Miami, or at University of Cincinnati. And there was one in California, University of California, Northridge, used to offer a cosmetic science program. But what you're looking at for people who really want to get started, read everything that you can that is published in the literature that is specific to cosmetics and drugs, OTC-type drugs. Specifically, there are several magazines, Cosmetic and Toiletries magazine by Allured Publishing, Global Cosmetic Industry, and Happy Magazine. These three magazines provide a lot of very useful information. Allured Publishing has taken over the publication of several very good books that I had the opportunity to read first editions of when I started off. Books like The Chemistry and Manufacture of Cosmetics, which is now edited by Mitch Schlossman, but originally written by Ed D. Navarre, who I knew personally. Harry's Cosmeticology. These are books that were originally written in the 30s and 40s, and yet the fundamental science in how to make an emulsion really hasn't changed that much. There's publications that are written about the HLB system, and people too often, particularly home crafters, too often try to hold the HLB system up as an absolute. And I keep trying to explain to them it is only a tool, that there is no absolute with the HLB system. It will help you reduce the total number of experiments you may need to use or make in an effort to try to create your product, but it is not an absolute. And then finally, my friend Henry Massa, who died a year and a half ago and is one of the lions of the industry, Henry Masso came to a Society of Cosmetic Chemists meeting down in North Carolina many years ago for the presentation. He was the featured speaker that night. And he stood up there and said, you know, most of you know about analytical chemistry, or you know about organic chemistry or inorganic. He said, but here in the cosmetics industry, we work with trichemistry. And the people started to scratch their head and look around. Truck industry, never heard of it. And Henry smiled and said, well, you try this, and if that doesn't work, you try this over here. And it was always such a iconic relief to hear Henry. But Henry had started in this industry back in the early 40s, and he had seen many, many changes. And when he retired as vice president of technical for Amicol, which was later purchased by Union Carbide, which in turn was purchased by Dow Chemical. And Amicol, which was originally the American Cholesterol Products Company, specialized in products that were made from lanolin and derivatives, whether these derivatives were ethoxylations, propoxylations, esterifications, etc. These were all based on lanolin, which is such a wonderful ingredient, although people tend to shy away from lanolin today because it's an animal-derived product. They fail to understand that the sheep are not killed in order to get the lanolin. They're only sheared. And you must shear sheep in order to keep the sheep comfortable. And the lanolin itself is basically the sebum of the sheep that is expressed out in their wool. But lanolin is a very wonderful product, and it still has uses in pharmaceutical products where they don't have the same phobias of animal-derived. So Henry, as I say, was quite a wonderful man in this industry, and he is certainly missed by those people that had the opportunity to work with and know him personally.
Yes, certainly. Now, you had said that you were one of the founders of the SEC chapter in the Carolinas.
Mm-hmm.
So how did that come about?
When I was working for Almay Cosmetics, we hired a new vice president of R&D, Peter Kaufman. And Peter had come to us from Max Factor, ironically enough. This is prior to Almay being bought by Beatrice. But Peter came to us from Max Factor. And at that time, as I said, we had a staff of three chemists. And he called us in for a staff meeting one morning. He said, you know, what do you guys do for SCC around here? And I told Peter, frankly, we don't do anything. We're covered by the Southeast chapter based out of Memphis. And while we have contacted them on several occasions to see if they would have a meeting over here in the Carolinas, they always refused. And Peter said to me, he says, Kevin, why don't you see what you can do to start a chapter here in the Carolinas? And I said, all right, fine. Well, to start a Society of Cosmetic Chemists chapter, you need to have at least 20 people in an area say that they want to form a chapter. We didn't have 20 people initially, and so the first thing I did was I started getting everybody in Almay who was qualified to sign up and become a member of the SCC. And I also further contacted the national office in New York City and said, what other companies do you know about here in the Carolinas? They told me a few. And I contacted those individuals and said, you got anybody else in those companies that are qualified to be members of the SCC? And so December 1980, I presented a petition to the national office with 49 names on it of people in the Carolinas who were members of the Society of Cosmetic Chemists requesting that we be recognized as a chapter. And we were granted that status at the December 1980 meeting. I was elected the first group chairman of the Carolinas group and also became a director of the national office of the SEC for the next 2 years.
What benefits have you seen that cosmetic chemists will get out of being part of the SEC?
Actually, there's quite a number of benefits. If you're local to an area where there's a chapter, certainly you get the opportunity to go to the periodic chapter meetings, where they will have speakers come in and talk about various aspects of cosmetic science. And I use the term science and not chemistry, because cosmetic science is more than just simply chemistry. It is also biology. It is instrumentation at times, organic chemistry, inorganic chemistry. They may talk about applications to skin or hair or OTCs. So you have a wide variety of subject areas that can be discussed at a chapter meeting. You have the opportunity to meet similarly minded individuals at these chapter meetings, and you can also further attend one of the two national meetings every year. In December every year, the New York chapter of the Society of Cosmetic Chemists, which is the largest chapter of the SEC, hosts the annual scientific meeting in New York City at the New York Hilton. And then every spring, usually in June, the various groups will host a group meeting or I should say a national meeting hosted by a specific group, an area, that will also bring out national speakers. And these annual meetings are generally two-day meetings as opposed to simply a dinner meeting.
Mm-hmm.
The Society of Cosmetic Chemists also offers an employment service. So if you're looking for a job, you can submit your resume to the SCC office, and employers can request resumes of individuals who meet certain criteria for what they're looking to hire. And vice versa, if you're an employer, you can go to the SCC and find qualified people to interview to see if you want to hire them for a position that you may have open. I mean, insofar as the SCC goes, I really can't say enough for it. As you are well aware, I know that you were at the New York meeting back in December, although I wasn't able to meet up with you then, Perry. Certainly, the Society of Cosmetic Chemists does offer many benefits. You have the Journal of the Society of Cosmetic Chemists, which comes out 8 times a year, I believe it is, which posts the best presentations at both national and chapter meetings. You've got the awards programs that the Society of Cosmetic Chemists sponsors. They sponsor educational scholarships for young chemists who want to advance within the cosmetics industry. They have the continuing education courses. There's just, you know, so many things that the best thing I can do is for people who are interested in the Society of Cosmetic Chemists, I would suggest that they go to simply scc.org and take a look at the website and see what the benefits are that they can gain from joining the Society of Cosmetic Chemists, and that if they are local to an area where there's a chapter that has a chapter meeting, that certainly those people can drop in on the chapter meeting. The New York Society of Cosmetic Chemists, the New York chapter, does not charge for unemployed members or for people who are visitors who want to come in and see what the SCC is about.
Mm-hmm.
And gain knowledge, and you know, if they like what they see, then they're certainly welcome to sign up and join the Society of Cosmetic Chemists.
Yeah, it's a great organization.
You can contact Kevin through his website, kylabs.com, or through email at kevin@kylabs.com, where he is available for consulting on cosmetic formulation of skincare, hair care, makeup, EPA-regulated FIFRA products, and OTC products. Thanks for joining our program, Kevin, and I look forward to speaking with you at an upcoming SCC meeting.
Well, thank you for having me, Perry. I enjoyed our discussion today, and I look forward to meeting you also, likewise, at an SEC meeting.
Okay, that's our show today. Since Kelly isn't here, I'm going to move on to a few quick announcements. I promise next episode we'll have another brain challenge. You can still sign up for my April 27th class on using the Internet productively as a cosmetic chemist, and also the June 2nd course on beginning cosmetic chemistry. Which will be held in conjunction with the SCC mid-year meeting in Long Island. Both of those can be signed up on at the Society of Cosmetic Chemists website, which is scconline.org. And speaking of online, news on the online training program that we're working on here at Chemist Corner. Now, space will be limited, so you can sign up for early notice by going to chemistcorner.com and clicking on the early sign up button at the top of the website. We've been a bit delayed, but are on track for starting this program this month, so keep listening and check the Chemist Corner website for more information. As always, if you have questions and comments about cosmetic science or the show, go to chemistcorner.com and leave your feedback there. Also, follow us on Twitter, Facebook, and you can also connect with us on LinkedIn. We're getting a lot of followers, and we really do appreciate that. If you want more information about how to connect with us, just look at the About page on Chemist Corner for more details. All right, that's all from us. Thanks, everybody, for tuning in. Now, go make a difference.